The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. Today, humanity needs a world order. As never before, world government is required if humankind is going to survive. And I mean in the next decade or so. I mean right now. I mean immediately ahead of us around the corner as we look at this world reeling with one shock after another of toppling governments, of the international problems of economies toppling here and there, of the floating of all major currencies, the skyrocketing Arab oil prices, all of the terrible problems domestically of the big nations, such as pollution, overpopulation, crime, divorce, and those problems. But look at the underdeveloped world and try to get some overview of the conditions in the world as a whole. If you were a president of the world and you were trying to give a state of the world message, you would have to show how about 90% of all humanity is poorly fed, ill clothed, poorly housed, many of them completely without shoes or any of the amenities that we would look upon as an absolute poverty level. How illiteracy is actually higher now than at any other time in our industrial revolution, jet space age, because as the populations in the nations which can least afford it continue to explode and grow all out of proportion to food production and to education, to the development of such countries, the disparity then between those who are educated, at least to a degree, and those who are completely illiterate grows more and more. As never before, simply because of the combined problems of pollution, population, proliferation of nuclear weapons, testing of nuclear weapons in spite of detente, the problems of government, of the economy, a lack of trust, an absence of faith, an absence of leadership. The world today reels from one shock to another. People panic. The buying habits of housewives in Tokyo can like as not affect the price of beef and milk and eggs in the United States of America. And the United States is expected to be the world's policeman, yet resented if it's interfering, as some people say, in the internal affairs of other countries. Human nature is at the root of it all. And human nature is largely uncontrollable. It's lust, vanity, jealousy, greed, the tribal and the group instinct. Nations seek to perpetuate their own ideals, their own religions. The growth of populations sometimes is embedded deeply in religious taboos or superstitions or simple tribalism and the desire to perpetuate one's own self. And here we are in a world reeling from one huge problem after another, going in no certain direction, voraciously devouring dwindling non-renewable means of survival, the natural commodities and resources that we find beneath the soil under our feet in this narrow ecosphere on which we live. From time immemorial, going clear back to the ancient Tower of Babel, mankind has recognized the need for some central world governing authority. He has desired world government. In one sense, the idea of the amalgamation of all races into one human race is as old as humanity itself. The desire for a common language, for a common religion, for common education, for one common flag and one common type of politic. It's as old as ancient Babylon. But today it is needed as never before. Now you can ask some of the greatest statesmen, some living, and of course having to look into the memoirs or the writings or the quotations and statements of many now long since dead, of what is the most urgent need for all of humanity today, and if you boil it down into the fewest words possible, you will find the words world government, or global authority. You will find that to be the most crucial and critical need for survival of all of human beings. It means that we, if we don't find some way to put the world in order, are going to share the common fate or the common destiny of whatever is the result of lack of order, of whatever will be the long-term result of today's willy-nilly caprice as nations vie for position economically, as the opening shots of trade wars get underway with nations closing their doors to the commodities of other countries, even inside trading partnerships such as Italy did to its own partners in the European Economic Community and as tiny Denmark did, which showed the fallacy of any real cohesiveness of the EEC and the fact that it lacked any framework upon which it could fall back in times of stress. You see whole governments that are virtually bankrupt as a result of the Arab oil embargo, then the rising prices when the embargoes were lifted. $1 billion a month is the red ink on the negative side of the ledger in Italy. And it's exactly the same in Britain. $1 billion a month is the rate of their going into the red as a national government. Now you can look all the way back to the ancient Tower of Babel, to the Greco-Persians, to the Roman Empire. You can look back to the days of World War I, the attempts at great empires to swallow up and gobble up the entirety of humanity, of bright dreamers envisioning some fantastic millennium German or Austrian or Austro-Hungarian style. You can look at Hitler and Mussolini, at the toadish egotism, the unbelievable swelling vanity of people who thought they owed it to all of humankind to rule the world German style, to bring us a Volkswagen in every garage and perhaps a stein of beer a couple, three times a week and dancing in the streets to German bands. That is, if we were pure Aryan and if we were acceptable. Unfortunately, there were millions upon millions who were unacceptable. They were people with names like Levy, Levine, Levi, Levy, Kuhn, Cohen, Kahn, Goldstein or Goldberg, or names like this all through Germany and all through Hungary and Yugoslavia and Poland, and lots of other names that you would recognize. And by the millions, they were exterminated, as were helpless political enemies and other people who fell under the heel of Nazi butchery and torture. And this was an attempt at world government. It was the idea of an idiot who had gone completely berserk, who perhaps was literally possessed of a spirit being that took over the powers of his mind and spoke through his own voice, as some people very close to him actually wrote and said and verily believed. And Adolf Hitler drenched the world in blood to try to bring about some type of anarchistic, false Christ-like world government. He wanted to usher in a millennium, with himself clearly visible at the absolute apex and pinnacle of power, of course. And such vanity is embarrassing, except that you see in reality in history, it's true. It's happened. It's been there. We've seen it. We've lived with it. We've gone through an era where we have seen the toadish, unbelievable, swelling vanity of a human being who actually thought he had the altruism, the wisdom, the ingenuity, the ability, the mentality, the education. He had the charisma. He had the knowledge. He had all of the mechanics at his control. He thought that he was the absolute apex of wisdom, of knowledge, of ability. And he just simply couldn't keep this from the rest of the world. The world needed what he had. So the former little Austrian paper hanger soaked the world in blood, trying to bring about what everybody really recognizes the world needs, a world order, except that it was man's government. It was done man's way. It was fraught and filled with all the dangers of rotten, cantankerous, vanity-ridden, egotistical, swelling, toadish human nature, which is filled with lust and greed, jealousy, ego, self-centeredness. And so the seeds of its destruction were sown at its birth. And so it is true of every attempt of human government all down through the blood-soaked pages of history, where humankind is recognized. Oh, nowhere near so much as we recognize today, with the fact that we have instant communication by global news media, even through satellites that ring and gird the globe out there hundreds of miles in space, where anything that happens somewhere else, where it's over in the vastness of some jungle or down in some swamp, or whether it's in the forests of Louisiana, or whether it's up in the Gobi Desert or the tip of the Italian boot, we hear about it next morning on the news. You watch the Today Show, you're going to get it fresh. And so, in our world today, we have come face to face with the knowledge that we need some overview, some global authority, some mechanics by which all nations, interdependently and in international or intranational cooperation, can live to learn together on this earth of ours with its tender, vulnerable, and very fragile and very thin ecosphere, with these billions of teeming human beings going about the business of polluting, besmirching, and blotching the face of the earth, scrabbling, growling away with their petty pursuits and jealousies as they listen to the whine and shriek and shrill and the meshing of gears of equipment as we scour, dig, and grub around on the surface of the earth for the means of survival and make a huge smoke and a dust in the air as we do it. You approach some of our big sprawling megalopolises from 39,000 feet a few hundred miles away, as I have done so many times, and you wonder, what in the world? The city is on fire. It's a fact. The city is on fire, you think. Every morning in the city of Los Angeles, the whole greater Los Angeles basin of Southern California, millions upon millions of human beings walk out of their flats and homes and apartments carrying keys. Millions upon millions of car doors are open. Millions upon millions of home stoves and millions upon millions of other machinery begin to whir and click and grind and hum and cough and snort away. Millions upon millions of locks click away as those keys open up, and then millions from 6 to 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning of automobiles begin to spew forth automobile exhaust. In a matter of a few moments, we're producing tons of air pollution that goes burgeoning and blossoming and billowing up into the skies just like an unfolding mushroom cloud of an atomic explosion. And it finds its ways up into the valleys and out across into the desert. Or if we have Santa Ana winds, as they call them, which is from the deserts near Los Angeles, inland, it blows all up to sea where ship captains have to navigate by radar as their eyes burn and their throats sting. In order to enjoy this good life, humanity grovels and gropes and digs and burrows in the surface of the earth to bring out the nickel and the iron and the tin and the silver and the gold, to bring out all of the ores that he uses, to pump all of the oil of the decaying bodies of ancient bygone animals and foliage of a once luxuriant age long since through tremendous catastrophes buried beneath the surface of the earth, which is a dwindling natural resource. And as we burn these fossil fuels and belch it up into the sky, we create a permanent haze layer in our own environment. And even worse than any animals ever do, we befoul our own nest to the point it's absolutely uninhabitable. And in our petty private jealousies, not recognizing that nevertheless our studies in cartography or geography in high school and college, the world isn't really colored yellow and green and red. And the world from up there at 39,000 feet or 100 miles or from the moon doesn't have all those political lines on it. It isn't brown in the mountaintops and green in the valleys. It's a kind of a dull brown color overall from outer space, with the deep blue of the ocean speckled by the white of the swirling clouds that make up our weather patterns. And it's a very vulnerable little tiny glittering speck of light in the midst of the blackness of nothing that is space. Nations basically developed along confluences of rivers, river valleys, estuaries, bays, delineated clearly by mountain ranges, islands, seas, lakes, rivers. Political boundaries that recognize no such natural boundaries are a thing of the comparatively recent past in history. But from outer space, you can't see any of that. What we ought to see is the same global view that some of the men who now have mental emotional difficulties from time to time saw it when they watched the earth rise. From out there, apparently you realize the incredible fragility of our system. The tiny little speck of light that is this earth. And maybe if more of the politicians and the people who are trying to run government could see the world in proper perspective instead of the world through the eyes of maybe their own bank account or their own personal perpetuation in the public eye, or what historians will say of them. Maybe if they could see it in international interests over and above national ones, or selfish or personal ones. But you know, that's a lot of wishful thinking, because human beings just are absolutely incapable of that. That's the point. Never before have we needed a world order, a world government. Humanity needs a world order. It needs the management of the entirety of the planet. It needs, in a sense, a world manager, not just a political figure. It needs someone at the helm of an international global power that would have authority that could really get things done. Authority to bring about, for example, instant zero population growth. But how would you do that? Let's just speculate about what kind of a governor, what kind of a ruler you would need. What would the qualities be? What kind of a capacity should he have? Like a Hitler? What kind of a mentality are we talking about? Somebody with the power to go to India and tell those people, look, you've got more protein running around on the hoof over here than we have in the entirety of the United States, yet you people are protein malnourished. You're starving to death while you walk around, filled with lethargy, because that's one of the signs of protein malnourishment. But you've got this religion, all of these gods, all of this polytheism, belief in Vishnu and all of these other gods. Now those are just false gods. There's the one great God that made the universe, the heaven and the earth, that set all of this in motion, that sustains it, who is the designer, the inventor of all law, who is the one who presently sustains it. How in the world would you or anybody, any organization of states even, have the power to go to countries with the unbelievable stifling problems of a nation like India, which in one sense, when you get out away from the big cities, is still a cow dung society, where even homes are made out of it? I'm not kidding you, that's the truth. Where illiteracy, the caste system is still there to a large degree, overcrowded, populous conditions where people through unbelievable living conditions, living in discarded sewer pipes, little junky ramshackle thrown together, corrugated tin and cardboard shanty towns with human excrement and urine running like trickling rivulets through the streets, if you can call them streets, that are more like paths, and I've seen it with my own eyes, I've been there, by the millions. How would such a world governor or ruler approach such problems? Well, now, look at the way the United States approaches it. The United States has, for so many years in post-war history, shipped aid, equipment, tools, hardware, food, money, nuclear reactors, you name it, all the way from the spectrum of the most complex and highly sophisticated technologies right on down to the simplest little staple like a bag of wheat. We've sent it to India. And much of it we've given away free. But there haven't been any strings attached. There haven't even been the strings attached that India ought to at least lean our way a little bit in voting against, once in a while, the Afro-Asian bloc, and with, once in a while, the United States in the United Nations. Instead, India, traditionally, has voted against the interests of the United States government, while at the same time being recipient of United States help. Yet we have not interfered. You can't cite a lot of terrible internal disturbances, revolts, riots, food wars, overthrow of government that you can lay to the door of the CIA in India, but you can cite the fact that both private and public agencies have with both hands diligently sought to allay starvation, that we have shipped hundreds of millions of bushels of wheat and rice and barley and food grains over to India and given it away when we knew that the price of wheat went up in black marketeers' hands to $25 a pound. We knew that because of poor storage, because of the black market, and the unbelievable hundreds of millions upon billions, perhaps, of rats that are there, that 50% of all the wheat we sent over there was eaten up or destroyed or disappeared, that only half of what we sent got to the people for whom it was intended, and many of them ended up paying for it when we sent it free. No, we haven't interfered. We haven't suddenly begun to educate all of the people of India to different religion, which would allow the balanced diet that they so desperately need. What kind of a world leader would it have to be that would have the power to change a world-famous, world-known religion which numbers adherents up into the hundreds of millions? What kind of a ruler could do that? You look at any problem, you could take it one by one. You could look at population. But there's tribalism. Look at population in Nigeria, Ghana, some of the nations of the Gold Coast, Togoland, Dahomey, Niger, Chad, some of the sub-Sahara areas of terrible overpopulation in the face of impending and growing drought and massive, immediate, imminent, I mean day by day, starvation. But the Igbos hate the houses, and the houses hate the Igbos. And when some Igbos have been educated in British universities, and they went back down there as dentists or doctors or philosophers or psychiatrists or leaders in politics and government or in the military, they tended to put their brothers and cousins and folks and family and friends. And when the houses saw that, they resented it, and vice versa. And so you had one of the bloodiest wars of any in human record. All of this since World War II, all of this within the last 5 to 7 years dragging on over there, and some of it still going on in isolated pockets that you never even hear about, and it's all basically tribalism. Now, how do you solve a population explosion, uncontrolled growth in population, when people, through taboos, superstitions, religions, and a simple desire to perpetuate their own tribe over that of another, and fearful of being wiped out by hostile neighbors, encourage 8, 10, 12, and 14 children per family? What kind of a ruler would we need? You can look at any problem you would like. The really big ones defy description. It's almost impossible to explain them and to really get a handle on them, to understand them, let alone to solve them. But you may not believe my next words, but it's true. You may not believe that the message that was brought to this earth by a visitor from outer space who plainly left that message behind, and it wasn't in some strange language, because it was face to face, voice to voice, man to man, person to person, carefully taken down by scribes, by secretaries, by his own students who sat there and listened to him, who visited this world from outer space and brought it the news of a coming world ruling government. His name was Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and he talked about a world ruling government. He talked about judgment set up in the earth. He talked about a world capital and law going forth to all the world out of that world capital. He talked about law and order. He talked about private property and land reform. He talked about agrarian reform with regard to crops, vineyards, and trees. He talked about even righting what is wrong with the weather. He talked about everything from leveling uninhabitable mountain areas to raising up of low, desert-like areas and making it all fertile and green and habitable for people. He talked about massive worldwide re-education. He even got down into little bitty specifics like people's private lives, the way neighbor ought to live with neighbor, even with regard to their cattle and pets. But nobody listened to that message. They took the message, twisted it up into something, and made it a Betty Bye story, like Linus with his thumb in his mouth and a kind of a hollow, dazed look in his eye with his blanket pressed to his ear, and said, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I awake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. Amen." Go say your prayers, children, and don't forget to mention grandmother. So we have presidential prayer breakfasts. We've got our evangelists, we've got our sawdust trails, we've got our preachers, religiosity, and we've got churchianity. We've got thousands of religions and hundreds of divisions of what we call Protestantism against Catholicism. We've got every kind of religion you can imagine, and a lot more new ones being born practically every single day, and that's all legal and well and good. Everybody's got a right to believe what he wishes, even those who still insist on a flat earth. But they took a dynamic message about a soon-coming solution for the environmental, political, religious, social problems of the entirety of the world and made it into a Betty Bye story about a nice, misunderstood, hurt martyr who is so totally turned off, so hurt, that he barely is able to keep his lower lip from trembling as he sits up there in this throne way off in Never Never Land, the other side of the Wizard of Oz's castle and private garden, and says, "Oh, I wish they would believe on me." And he has all these types, from women who are frustrated actresses to the pot-bellied, hoarse, rasping, wheezing guys who go to that college about how to learn to speak like an evangelist, that make all these unbelievable, broken-hearted, just barely kicked in the stomach with a double nine, triple A, or whatever Brogan sick sound saying, "Won't you come? Won't you believe on the Lord?" And there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people that believe in that kind of thing, and they think that you're going to go to heaven. Who in the world would want to do that? Right down the earth, that's where all the problems are. And why would you want to go to heaven when Jesus said he's coming back down here and talked about an invasion from outer space involving armies from heaven, involving millions upon uncounted millions of angels, involving a resurrection to life of hundreds of millions and eventually all of the human race, which Jesus himself talked of over and over and over again. And the repetitiveness of the word resurrection in the earlier chapters of the history book of the early church that Jesus left after he established it, almost monotonous, isn't it, when you read through Acts 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, where the apostles are saying there is coming a resurrection and Christ is going to come again, where the apostle Paul talked about he is coming with clouds and every eye shall see him. That's also in the book of Revelation, the apostle John, where it talks of a literal invasion, where it talks of setting up a world-ruling government with laws, with a capital, with a governmental system, with the vast reforms that are listed in the book of Zephaniah, the book of Isaiah, Ezekiel, talking about old waste places that are going to be built up, talking of every human being owning a little piece of property. That's right. That's what the Bible talks about. World government. It's funny. When you look at some of the books, the magazines, or the reports of journalists on world leaders who have said the creation of a world government is absolutely required, it's the only way for the survival of the human race, and yet they will come right up to the inescapable conclusion and back off from it. What is that inescapable conclusion? By the thousands, the top thinkers in think tanks, politicians, statesmen, all agree that the world needs world government. And those same thousands come right up to the point, and I quote this from a book called World Politics, the creation of a world government through the voluntary agreement of existing nations is so unlikely that we can say flatly that it will never happen. Then I could waste the next 2 hours, which I don't have because I'm running out of time, to give you the quotations of everybody. You would recognize the names by the dozens. Doctors, generals, politicians, statesmen, heads of state, heads of think tank institutes, heads of educational institutions who would say, unless humanity finds a world order, a world government, humanity is doomed. I mean, they sound like a bunch of doomsday prophets. Even people like former President, late President Eisenhower, and men of this stature, late President John F. Kennedy, so many names you would recognize who plainly said, we need a world government. They come right up to the point, we've got to have a world government or we will perish. Then they say, but we can say flatly it will never happen. Well, what's your alternative? We're all going to perish, right? No, not right. The closest I ever heard anybody come to it was an editorial in a leading weekly news magazine some years ago that said, what is needed is a strong hand from someplace. That was the closest they came to saying, the world needs the second coming of Jesus Christ. But that would be so embarrassing to most of humanity, they simply couldn't mouth the words. You write for this booklet called, Is This the End Time? And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.